This is Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from Laughlin, Nevada, overlooking the beautiful Colorado River at the Aquarius Resort. And, of course, it's a UFO Congress, and it's an incredible conference. Lots of international guests, lots of movers and shakers in the business, always unusual people. And we have a great person here with us that works with us occasionally, Paula Harris. How are you?
Pretty good. Thank you for having me.
Where did you all get together, in Stanford?
We were at Stanford Research Institute. Hal Puthoff and I started a program to investigate psychic abilities. We had both been laser physicists. Hal was at Stanford University, and I was at Sylvania. I was building lasers, and Hal was investigating lasers for his PhD. And we met at a conference where he was lecturing on Soviet research in extrasensory perception, which is a subject that I had been lecturing as well. And we got together and thought that since we lived near one another in Palo Alto, California, that maybe we could interest Stanford Research Institute in actually starting a program. But, of course, money is necessary for that. So in the course of looking for government support, we went to the CIA and we went to NASA, and both of them agreed to support our program.
Did you? There was a story, Russell, that you told once that Wernher von Braun had a psychic grandmother, and that's how he got the money to do a lot of the research. It was a joke you were telling, but Wernher von Braun was involved in this too, right?
Well, in my experience trying to get money for ESP research, what I discovered is that everybody has a psychic grandmother. In this particular case, I had been invited to give a lecture at a conference on speculative technology on St. Simon's Island off the coast of Georgia. A NASA administrator, George Pesdert, had invited me to lecture on the work I was doing privately, teaching people to get in touch with the part of themselves that's psychic. I had built an ESP teaching machine. And Pesdert from NASA invited me to this quite high-level conference off on St. Simon's Island. And after I gave my lecture, I then walked out onto the pier with Wernher von Braun and the administrator of NASA, Jim Fletcher, and Arthur C. Clarke, and Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut.
So I. A group of people, Jerry.
That's quite a walk.
I know.
So what I knew is that if I behaved myself and did things properly, these are the men who could provide the financial support to get me out of laser research and eventually fund a program in extrasensory perception. And I told them that I had built this four-choice electronic trainer that allowed people to choose which of four buttons to select, indicating which of four lights they thought was going to come on, and people can learn to achieve a relationship. What I proposed to von Braun is that astronauts who would work with this machine could achieve a rapport with the electronic random number generator and learn to get in touch with the part of themselves that's psychic, as it were, so they could achieve a rapport with their spacecraft, so that the American astronauts could learn to become psychic and in tune with their spacecraft. I learned a couple of years later that the Soviets were already doing that particular thing. I had lunch with cosmonaut Sevastyanov, who is a Soviet cosmonaut, and he told us that when in orbit, he and his fellow cosmonauts dropped into a kind of telepathic rapport with one another, and they could sense when things are going wrong with the spacecraft that they're riding on. So it's as though being out of the Earth atmosphere and away from the electromagnetic chatter on the Earth, they're able to become more psychic and more in tune with their own psychic selves. So they're psychic with each other and with the spacecraft.
Did you find that held true in later years with other people traveling into space, other experiences?
I did not hear that from other space travelers, although Edgar Mitchell, as you know, had a epiphany of a psychic kind, a transformational experience, when he was returning from the moon to Earth. And he also did ESP card guessing experiments at that time, where he found that people on Earth were significantly able to correctly guess the cards that he had with him in his Apollo spacecraft. So that there is a connection between psychic ability and being outside the Earth's atmosphere and away from the chatter, the electromagnetic chatter. For example, at our laboratory at Stanford, we found that people behave more psychically and actually are able to improve their remote viewing by being inside of an electromagnetic screen. So we did most of our work for the government and for research inside of a shielded enclosure, a so-called Faraday cage. And what we find is that over the years, there is a literature, starting with Andrea Puharic, who's a physician and ESP researcher in the 50s. What he found is that people do better and feel more psychic when they're inside of a Faraday cage. So we did all of our work that way. The work we were doing at Stanford was to investigate an ability that we call remote viewing. It was named remote viewing by Ingo Swann. And this is an ability that we all have to look into the distance, look into the future, and describe and experience things that are blocked from our ordinary perception. And we did that very significantly, so much so that our program was supported by the Central Intelligence Agency, Defense Intelligence Agency, Army Intelligence, NASA, and so forth. We're supported for 23 years at the tune of about $25 million to provide information to the intelligence community about various overseas activities. As we looked in at Chinese atomic bomb tests, Soviet weapons factories, we helped with the find American General Dozier, who was kidnapped in Verona and taken to Padua, and the great psychic Joe McMonagle was able to identify where in this new city he had actually been kidnapped. And we found a downed Soviet airplane. We did a number of applications over that period, which is how we kept ourselves funded for the 23-year time period.
Can anyone become a remote viewer, or is it a certain type of... do you have to have a lot of intelligence already, or does that have anything to do
with it? Well, intelligence always helps no matter what you're trying to do.
I imagine you're
But remote viewing is not a kind of IQ test. Everybody has some amount of psychic abilities. So the thing that brought me to this UFO conference is to show that psychic ability is very widely distributed, and in a typical three-hour lecture demonstration, most of the people in the audience will either do something psychic or see something psychic. The connection between ESP and UFOs was really first described by Jacques Vallée, the prolific writer on UFO topics for three decades, where Jacques says that the observations of UFOs are very important both from a sociological and a scientific point, but in his opinion, many, many of the UFO sightings are neither objects nor flying. As UFOs are generally unidentified flying objects, but he thinks that there's a large mental concomitant to the UFO experience. For example, oftentimes people are looking at UFOs in the sky and they disappear rather than flying away. Or they're looking at a UFO in the sky and of the four people gathered, two can see it and two cannot. So there's often a surprising psychic or psychological part to the UFO experience.
So is it like a psychic moment when the two people can see it and the other people can't? It's like their awareness goes into either another dimension or another level that they can see it?
It certainly seems like that. That is, there's a nuts and bolts component as well. That is, UFOs are tracked by radar, and when they land in the grass, they make an impression in the grass, and they can be seen and photographed, so they certainly have a physical aspect. They also have this peculiar non-physical aspect, which makes them seem part real, or let's say part material, part psychic or psychological. We really don't know what UFOs are, of course, but Jim Dolan, who wrote a wonderful book, in my view, the most comprehensive...
Richard Dolan.
Thank you very much. Richard Dolan wrote a very comprehensive book called UFOs and the National Security State. And in that, he says, as a historian, a professional historian, what Dolan says is that I only know two things for sure about UFOs after writing this 500-page books. One of the things that he knows for sure is that something like UFOs really exist. And the other thing he knows for sure is that the government is lying about them.
You know, you've been in the government, at least funded by them. Do you think anyone in the government knows a little bit more and they're not speaking about UFOs, or really are we all in the
government? Well, I'm sure that some people in the government know more about them. That is, in the so-called MJ-12 documents that Ryan Wood and his father, Bob Wood, just released in book form, and now there's a new DVD called The Secret, discussing the MJ-12 documents, it's very clear that there have been a history of government interest in UFOs extending back to the 1940s.
You know where I'm going, so have you tried remote viewing to contact extraterrestrials on UFOs?
Well, many of the people involved in the program at SRI, Ingo Swann and Pat Price, who are two of our very most successful remote viewers, were also very involved and experiencers in the UFO arena. Now, as a scientist, it's not very rewarding to do... it's not very rewarding to do remote viewing of a flying saucer. For example, if I quieted my mind, I say, there's one now, I can travel inside, I see this, that, and the other, hear the aliens, hear what the beings look like, and I write that down, but that's just my story. There's no way to validate that. As a researcher, I like to do remote viewing of objects or situations that eventually give us some feedback. For example, the most important thing that we learned about psychic abilities from our 25 years at SRI is that psychic abilities, and remote viewing in particular, is a non-local ability. That is to say, it's independent of space and independent of time, and we're quite confident of that. We've done experiments that show very clearly that it's no harder to look across the planet from San Francisco to China or from San Francisco to Moscow than it is to look across the street. That is, increasing the distance 1,000-fold doesn't decrease the accuracy or the reliability at all.
One thing I'm kind of confused about is, can you see the future in remote viewing, or is it always the present?
Not only can we see the future, we have seen the future. We've done many precognitive experiments. In fact, early in the program, the CIA came to us and had a task for Ingo Swann where the CIA agent said to Ingo, something's going to happen in China 4 days from now, could you describe that? And he gave Ingo the geographical coordinates, latitude and longitude. He said, now I want you to cast your mind ahead 4 days from Monday to Thursday, and what's going to happen at these coordinates next Thursday? And Ingo said, well, this is very interesting. This is very beautiful. Get me some colored pencils. And when I gave him colored pencils, he drew a succession of hemispherical colored pyrotechnic displays. It looked like a fireworks demonstration that you'd see on the 4th of July. And he said, what I see is a beautiful pyrotechnic display in many colors, and there are a bunch of trucks off in the background. And that information was all the CIA needed to confirm that the Chinese were indeed going to carry out an atomic bomb test 4 days in the future, and in fact it would fail. Because what Ingo saw is the telltale, reliable signature of burning uranium that does not explode, but just burns in a kind of pyrophoric bonfire, sending streamers up into the air like a 4th of July display, which is what you get when you burn uranium that fails to explode. So Ingo was able to look 4 days in the future, correctly identify that an atomic bomb test is what was going to occur at that location, and then he could cast his mind ahead into that time frame and see that they would do the test and that it would fail.
There's one danger to remote viewing, though, you mentioned in your lecture yesterday, Russell, and that is that if people really get into it and people are really good at remote viewing, people are really good with their ESP, they can tell when someone is lying.
Oh, that's very true. When I was once lecturing in the Soviet Union about these kind of experiments after I had left the SRI program, the SRI program was classified secret, so I couldn't talk to anybody while I was part of the program. But once I was in the Soviet Union lecturing to the Academy of Sciences, one of the concerned physicists stood up and said, "If what you say is true, doesn't it mean that nothing is secret anymore?" And I had to confirm, indeed, that there are no secrets, because the remote viewer is able to quiet his mind and describe what is the case. Basically, anytime you have a question that actually has an answer, the remote viewer can give the answer. Probably the most famous remote viewing that we did was not part of the SRI program, but after I left the program, I created a company called Delphi Associates, and one of our entertaining projects was to systematically forecast changes in the silver commodity market. What we wanted to find out is whether we could make money using ESP.
And
well,
You guys made money.
Right. The short answer is we were successful. The reason this was an interesting program is that it would be nice if you could just quiet your mind and look up at the big board at the commodity exchange and read whether silver has gone up or down at the end of the week. But you're not able to read psychically, at least most of us are not. So we had to, the psychic functioning is a non-analytical ability. That is, naming and guessing and grasping and reading.
Do you actually see a vision in your mind, or is it more of just a feeling?
It's seeing a vision in your mind.
Didn't you use knives and forks or something like that, a fork and spoon, to see positive and negative?
Yes, we used associative remote viewing, which is a kind of remote viewing that Stephen Schwartz taught us. Schwartz was the proprietor of the Mobius Society at the time, and he recognized that you can't read numbers psychically. But his scheme from his Navy work as a cryptographer is that you can make an association between the changes in the silver market that you're interested in and little objects that are quite easy to describe. For example, if I put a teddy bear in a box and bring it to you and say, "Tell me what's in my box," an experienced remote viewer will have no problem describing, "I see something soft and brown and it looks like an animal," as compared with a fork, which would be something shiny and metallic and pointy. So in the remote viewing we did, we made use of this associative remote viewing, where each week the broker in San Francisco would choose four objects. For example, he might choose a light bulb and a pancake and a wine bottle and a carnation. And he might decide the carnation represents the market going up a lot. The wine bottle might represent going up a little. The fork might be going down a little, and the pancake might represent going down a lot. Now, I, of course, as the interviewer in this two-person game, would not know anything about the objects. So I would turn to my psychic that I'm working with, say Paula, for example, who's sitting right here, and I say, here we are on Monday. We want you to describe, please, what I'm going to put in your hand next Friday. I don't know what it could be. It could be any kind of thing, but I'd just like you to cast your mind ahead and describe what you're experiencing with regard to what I will put in your hand at 4 o'clock next Friday.
Carnation.
And Paula might say, I feel something that's kind of round and floppy, and it has a bad smell. They're just rather disgusting, floppy, round, soft, squishy. I don't like this thing. I don't know what it is. That's what I get. So I would then call up the broker and say, broker, I got this very odd description from Paul about this round, floppy object with a funny smell. Do you have anything like that? He'd say, well, yes, that's my object that corresponds to down a lot. It's a pancake left over from my breakfast. So based on Paula's excellent description of the leftover pancake, we would sell silver on Monday with the anticipation that it would go down during the week and we could buy it back at a lower price at a later time. It's called short selling. We did that activity on 9 consecutive weeks, of course, always with different object sets, and we were successful every time in this 1-in-4 game. 100% successful. We made $120,000 doing remote viewing. So the answer to people who say God won't let you use your psychic ability to make money, that's simply not correct.
I think, Jerry, we should think about this with Russell.
he's my new partner.
He's my new partner, too. We'll start a company.
And we did that with a famous psychic who was very experienced doing that. And that was 1982, a long time ago. And
was
then
that McMonagle?
No, it was somebody different.
Oh, somebody different, okay.
Then in 95, I wrote a book with Jane Catra, who's a spiritual healer. We wrote a book called Miracles of Mind, and the publisher said, if you folks are describing how to do remote viewing, you ought to demonstrate that you can do it. Can you show that you two people actually know what you're talking about? So Jane and I set up a silver forecasting experiment with two other friends of ours who are professional mathematicians. They chose the targets, and they set up the whole transaction. And in a period of a dozen weeks, Jane and I each week would make a forecast for the silver market, and we were correct 11 out of 12 times.
Still good.
Yeah. We were just forecasting, is it going up or is it going down? So we had an easier task. But doing anything correctly 11 out of 12 times is pretty hard to do.
I'm impressed. I don't know why he's here. He ought to be back at the silver market.
But what you might want to talk about, because we've looked at the very mundane applications of remote viewing, is the healing part. Because with Jane Catra, you've written a book called Miracles of Mind, but it dealt with healing. This same kind of ability, the ability of projecting what we have as these kind of powers or senses, can also help us in our everyday life and healing, right?
Now, this was understood a long time ago. Patanjali, who's a great Hindu writer 100 years before Christ, wrote in his sutras, the sutras of Patanjali, he wrote that once you clear your mind and have an opportunity to experience this expanded awareness, you can see into the distance, see into the future, heal the sick and diagnose illnesses, and we have been able to demonstrate all of those things. Remote viewing is an opportunity to inflow information from the distance or from the future. And one additional kind of information that you can inflow is information about the medical and mental state of a distant person, and that's called intuitive diagnosis. Two of the famous practitioners are Judith Orloff in Los Angeles, who's wrote a very interesting book called Second Sight, and Mona Lisa Schultz in Boston.
And Edgar Casey in Newport Beach, but that was a long time ago.
Mona Lisa Schultz's book is Awakening Intuition, And perhaps the most famous medical intuitive is the woman who worked with Norm Shealy, who we'll think of her. Carolyn Meese has written many books about her experiences with medical intuition.
When we talk about these things, are you saying that the person doesn't even have to be in a room, that you can still diagnose their health problems?
That's right.
Across the planet someplace?
Yeah, it's better if they're not in the room, because doctors learn to do snap diagnoses where they look at the person who walks in the room and can tell in a flash that's a gallbladder that just walked in, or that person has diabetes. I had a housemate who had learned to do intuitive diagnosis at the Berkeley Psychic Institute, and she thought that I should be able to do that because of my experience with remote viewing. So the first thing that I did in following her instructions was to purchase the 36 hours of anatomy and physiology tape from the teaching company so that I would have an idea analytically of what I was looking at. And then I asked my teacher, Catherine, to bring me cards in individual envelopes shuffled up so that when she would hand me a card carrying the name of a distant person, she wouldn't know who it was. Because otherwise, if she just hands me a card for her Aunt Tilly, then I can become very skillful at reading Catherine's mind with regard to her opinions about Aunt Tilly, and that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to learn to contact the distant person directly. So she would give me an envelope containing a card of a distant person, and then I would describe my mental impressions regarding the health of that person.
Wow.
And that turned out to be much easier than ordinary remote viewing. I was very successful. Even as a straight-up physicist, that turned out to be quite easy to do. In one of my very first trials, I just held the envelope in my hand and mentally visualized the body of the person from top to bottom, and I saw their organs in this nice pale blue fashion as I was accustomed to in the video and in the DVDs I was looking at. And then when I got down to their pancreas, which I recognized, I saw it had this sort of ugly orange color. And I said, I see this really distorted, ghastly-looking pancreas. This person looks to me like a diabetic. And that was the right answer. And that was my very first intuitive diagnosis. It was perfectly accurate and took about as long to do as it took to describe.
We'll be right back with Russell Targ, the guru of modern-day remote viewing, and Paula Harris, one of the great reporters in the world today. Tales of High Strangeness, Jerry Pippin's Parazone. Check out our stories of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual, on the paranormal pages of JerryPippin.com.